This TFMR podcast is brought to you by your friends at JM Bullion. Visit jmbullion.com for all your gold and silver bullion needs. Well, greetings once again to everybody at TFMR. Hey, it is Thursday, November the 15th. Beware the Ides of November. This is your Thursday conversation, and we're going to have some fun today. I've been looking forward to getting caught up with my old pal, Ned Naylor Leyland. Ned, as you all know, is a world-renowned advocate of sound money. He is a true Renaissance man, as I like to call him, an international man of mystery. But his day job is he is a fund manager of a gold and silver fund, actually called the Marion Global Investors Gold and Silver Fund, which, Ned, correct me if I'm wrong, owns some bullion but also mining shares, correct?
Yes, all of that is true except international man of mystery. But other than that, I'll wear it all.
All right, I'll take it. So anyway, again, with so much going on in the world, a perfect time to get caught up with our old pal Ned. I keep calling you old. Even, you're younger than I am. But you wear that well as well, my friend. Anyway, how are you?
Yeah, I'm very good. I'm surprisingly chipper, despite... you know, what's going on with our favorite asset class. I think overall markets look a bit rocky, so hopefully that may help us. But no, all in all, we're well in London.
All right, well, and tell everybody about this Marion Global Investors and the transition, the name change and all that stuff. And tell everybody about your fund. Who can buy it? Which country do you need to live in to buy it? All that kind of stuff.
Yeah, so I'm not sure what I'm even allowed to say, if I'm completely honest. I certainly don't want to get in trouble with anybody for promoting it. So I just basically, I don't think it's available to U.S. investors.
Okay.
But it's a globally available fund that invests in both bullion and gold and silver mining stocks. My key differentiator is that I have 20% in bullion and overweight silver to drive the return profile. That's the difference really compared to other products. But yeah, we used to be called Old Mutual Global Investors. We're now called Merion, based out of London near St. Paul's.
All right, my friend, while I've got you on the line, there are a number of timely issues to discuss. And I thought I'd kick right off with this whole Brexit thing, my man. I mean, two and a half years ago, this vote happens. It now looks like they're trying to implement it. Look, your boots on the ground right there in jolly old London, Ned. What the hell's going on?
Well, look, what's interesting, I think you can see what's happening just by looking at the behavior of cable. Look at sterling dollar, the way it's behaving. It's lurching about around 1.5%, 2% a day at the moment based on rumor, counter-rumor. I mean, there's no doubt that the UK has stumbled along on the back of the vote for nearly 2 years in a state of confusion. I think there are still many, many ways this can play out, including nothing happening at all or a full no-deal exit. I mean, I think that the interesting thing, of course, is more how this plays out for the rest of the Eurozone, because the young people of many other countries in Europe, in my view, would like to see the super state and its minions get a bloody nose. There are big structural problems in Europe to do with unemployment, centralization. I think right now where we are is Mrs. May is probably not going to last more than another week from here. I'd be surprised if she does. Whether that triggers a general election or not, I'm not sure. Probably, I imagine it will. And then, you know, I think people who voted for Brexit will be furious if there's a second referendum, and I think they're quite right to feel like that. But, you know, beyond that, I think a little bit of the chaos that's already been there and been in the background for 2 years has just re-emerged rather than anything else.
So if she can't get it done, Ned, and she dances her way out of office, and I would assume you can dance better than she can. Anyway, if she dances her way out of office, Is that a likelihood, do you think? Would there be a second referendum?
Well, I think I probably do dance a bit like her. but yeah, no, I think that there shouldn't be a general election. What should happen is someone who actually supports Brexit should take over. There are various candidates for that. But I think that the state is desperate to get the right answer rather than what it perceives to have been the wrong answer. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that's really what will happen. I don't think there should be another general election. I think the baton should be picked up by somebody who really wants to deliver the will of the people, whether you agree that's the will of the people or not. That was the result of the vote. And it should be delivered, but I'm dubious that will happen. But it's there's a nice amount of political chaos. And as one of my sales guys said to me today, he says, I just don't understand, how does gold help in this environment? And I said, well, it's the only asset that is free of and a hedge against politics. And he looked at me in amazement and was like, oh. So I think it's a bit of political, do us any harm, really, is golden.
Right, exactly. All right, so let's take this another step into what is really seemingly causing problems in all global markets at this point is the strength of the dollar and rising U.S. interest rates. I mean, the dollar index, 60% is a euro. So if this Brexit thing continues to impact not only the pound but the euro, maybe that eventually impacts the dollar. I mean, what's going on globally, it has to have an impact not only on the U.S. markets but everywhere. It's a problem, obviously. How do you see all this kind of sorting itself out as we get into next year, Ned?
I tend to think the people who will be listening to this are quite well informed on this subject anyway. But this week I was presenting with one of my colleagues who runs a very big global equities product, and he was talking about dispersion between US equity investors and everyone else, and saying that what we're seeing at the moment is has not been seen before since 1970. Now, that triggered a thought in my mind, which I thought was very interesting, which is that effectively what he's saying is that there's such an overweight global long in US equities compared to everywhere else, and that's where the action's happening, and it hasn't happened since 1970. And it occurs to me that of course, is just before a big change in the monetary system.
Yeah.
And I think that we all think that's coming again. So I think that there's an element of money is issued from its source. Now, of course, the pre-1970 arrangement, the dollar was still reserve currency. Fine, it was convertible to gold, but it was still the launching pad for global capital, both out and in. And if you imagine it all flowing away, and then in a period of stress coming back home, the back end of the 1960s and 1970, before the actual change happened in 1971, you could definitely look at now and say maybe something similar is happening, which is, of course, the dollar is still the world's reserve currency. There are huge changes happening in the background, and I think they are massively under discussed.
Yeah.
And we can touch on that. But yes, I think it's probably more a case of, throw a stone in a pond and the ripples go out. And then, if it's a beaker rather than a pond, then they'll ripple back in again. I think it's potentially an indication of the end of this this monetary system. Not just to talk our own book, but I think there is an echo there.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the million-dollar question as we roll into next year and, I guess, beyond. The dollar versus all the other fiat has strengthened this year. No, not a lot, but 5 or 6% maybe? And that seems to be now...
less than people say. People say make a bigger deal, I think, of this than is really the case.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that one would have expected more, actually, in my opinion. And I think that the thing that's interesting, again, I've been on this rebranding roadshow, and I've spent a lot of time with different teams, including the head of our bond desk. And he was, I showed him actually Luke Gromman's research on, on the dollar. And he liked it very much, and he was very much in agreement that the US is in a very dangerous position with respect to its ability to fund itself, and that he is very much bearish of the dollar from here. The inability to roll debt long, the lack of foreign participation in US treasuries is a very bad sign. I saw that the projected borrowing for 2018 is $1.3 trillion this year, US government, which is more than double last year. You know, all of this is pointing to a big structural issue, which people aren't really talking about. There are a few people talking about it. I think Dalio mentioned it as well. But it's true that there are certainly fairly interesting and valid contrary arguments to that. But my bias is towards, actually, I think the dollar has run its race here. I think it probably is going lower versus the euro, which sounds a little surprising. But that's the way I see it right now.
You know, I wonder, Ned, do you think, you know, what I've seen numbers, $15 trillion, $17 trillion worth of global QE since 2009. Do you think that that's just like kind of enough to get us through for a while? I mean, at least through this point, because it seems as if there, whenever bonds, at least in the U.S., need to find a bid, they do, you know, and rates, instead of going higher on the long end, are flat. And you can clearly see anytime the 10-year note gets up to 3.25%, the stock market crashes.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would ignore the long bond. I'd ignore the monetized part of the debt market. What I'm more interested in, and I think is more important, is the cutting edge of the credit market. So, you know, where the problems are most likely to manifest, and they're clearly there in a major way. You know, the market's ignoring it, but the deterioration in auto loans, in credit card delinquencies, in all the stuff which you would expect to see first, is massively there. Now, for me, all that shows is, well, exactly what all of us would have said all along, which is you can't go looser and looser for 30 years and then pull the plug. It's not going to work. And at the margin, that does seem to be the case. So look, you know, all the assumptions that we're discussing here are built on the premise that the last 5 years carries on forwards. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think they are. I think you can see in credit that that's not happening. Therefore, it's only a matter of time before we stop the narrative of normalization and tightening. Whether we head the opposite direction, I'm not sure. But that moment will be the catalyst for gold to go when that happens. Yeah. When the bond market realizes, oh, wow, this is not actually happening now, then we'll go.
Yeah.
So I think that that's what matters. And for me, credit is the key leading indicator, and that's what I'm paying attention to.
Yeah, I hear you. All right. Now, I also want to talk about, since, again, you're in London, at least most of the time, when you're not being an international man of mystery. In London, we have the LBMA, and it is inextricably linked at this point with the COMEX as part of the entire global pricing structure. And we know the LBMA is just a con job of unallocated metal, you know, and all of the alleged tonnage of trading that they do on a daily basis. Ned, there's been a lot of talk there about increasing the transparency of the LBMA. what can you tell us about some of the friendly LBMA people you've met over there and the likelihood of that market becoming more transparent?
Yeah, the friendly people at the LBMA. I think actually it's my greatest badge of honor. I am definitely their least favorite person in London. so much so that I slightly doorstepped their pizza and ping pong party that they had. You may remember this 2 years ago. When that particular political story was also around, and I basically sent an email to Ruth Crowell at the LBMA saying I'd like to come along to their pizza and ping pong party. And I think she felt she had to let me go. So I turned up, and there was an actual real-life 7-foot-tall Marine who'd been posted on the door specifically to chaperone me, which was a really surreal moment. And I took him to the bar and had a pint with him, and explained to him why I find the LBMA interesting and what it gets up to. And, of course, he loved it. He was absolutely fascinated. But I don't think that was quite what he was employed to do, was to sit there listening to me telling him about the LBMA. But look, I think that what matters is to see, really, it's put up or shut up time right now. You know, they've said that in a week or 10 days or whenever it is, that they're going to be giving us the gross statistics of daily trading over the counter. You know, I mean, first point is, really, let's see. Second point would be, bear in mind that this only includes LVMA banks. I make this point quite often, and very few people do make this point. You know, there are massive, massive amounts of over-the-counter naked gold trading going on outside the LVMA. I mean, probably, I don't know if it's as much, but it's vast as well. So whatever number you're seeing is certainly not representative of the whole either. But, you know, if they fudge again, then, you know, it's laughable. But I think that also my analysis of the LVMA has changed a little bit lately as I've reread some books that I read a while ago. And I realized that, sadly, I think the OTC LVMA gold market is kind of pretty much like the dark heart global sort of black arts capital movement. You know, it's the best possible way to launder illicit proceeds through the financial system, if you think. And I fear that really that's really what it is. You know, more than anything, that's really what it's about and always has been. Because, of course, there's so much unregistered gold at the end of World War II, which has been used to fund all sorts of things. And I'm sure that plays a huge role in what goes on in the LVMA. So therefore, expecting any kind of transparency or anything like that is a fool's errand, really.
Yeah.
I mean, calling them out for it is important, and we must continue to do this. But expecting actually anything really meaningful to come from them, I think, is not really likely.
Yeah, no, I hear you. All right, so while we're on the subject, let me ask you about two side points that I've been following and curious about as of late. One is the palladium market, which is making new all-time highs. I hear rumors, I see data. David Jensen is a guy who's been all over this, tracking down lease rates for palladium on the LBMA and how they're through the roof, indicating their extreme physical shortages. And what David says is the last time this happened in 2001, which was the last time price was at this level, that the Russians were convinced to ride to the rescue with physical palladium and bail out the LBMA. The Russians aren't going to do that this time, if that's the case, obviously. Do you think, is there any chance something like that, a palladium, which nobody pays attention to, could at least, though, you know, be the crack in the dam, you know, that all of a sudden sets off a chain reaction of people going, wait a second, hold on just a minute. If palladium is like this, well, then maybe gold and silver really are? I mean, is that a plausible theory at all, do you think?
I think it's a plausible theory. I don't know enough about that, is the first thing, about palladium. I tend to think that the bullion banking system and the stunning ignorance, or rather, let's be generous, lack of understanding of financial professionals of monetary metals could lead them to say almost anything and they'll believe it anyway.
Yeah.
So I'm a bit dubious about this, really, if I'm honest. I've seen this narrative and I don't know much about it. I wouldn't necessarily stand around waiting for that to be it, but I mean, you know, I'm welcome all comers to create a ripple, and if that's it, then great. But I wouldn't go all in on that one.
All right, here's the second one. We continue to see, and this has gone on now for years, obviously. But what was it just in September? 90 metric tons of gold or whatever it was exported from the UK into Switzerland, and then you can track Switzerland exports that then go out to, you know, India and Hong Kong and China. I mean, look, Ned, there, as far as I know, there are no gold mines there anywhere there in the UK. You got the little, you know, Irish guys with the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But other than that, where the hell is this gold coming from? I mean, is it just this vast store underground in London that is, you know, never going to run dry? Where is this gold coming from?
Well, just be careful. I mean, I think for me, you slightly sort of made the point there yourself by saying that UK doesn't have any gold mines. Well, Philippines became the world's number three or two even gold producer from nowhere as well back in the 1970s or early 80s at best. And they had very little gold production too. So, you know, just realize that the invisible global black bullion market is a way bigger than we realize. Much, 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 much bigger. I mean, for me, when people talk about two Olympic swimming pools of physical gold, I'll outrank that 5 or 10x. That would be my view. I can't justify that, but I can based on what I've read and what I understand to be the case. So I have no idea where it comes from or whether it wouldn't or would. But I would worry that narrative about there's no mining and where's the physical and there's no float, you know, ultimately keeping the jig going is what matters, and influence can be put to bear to make that happen, to make physical appear from places you wouldn't imagine it exists.
So, again,
just be careful about assuming things, I think.
But here's kind of a disconnect. So we can continue to flow 80, 90 tons a month through Switzerland, but yet, you know, the Germans have to, you know, they could get 7 tons the first year as they were trying to repatriate. And I think they've all gotten it now after 3 years or whatever it is. Or Maduro, you know, gets told to go pound sand for his 14.
This is all the same point, which is it comes down to how much leverage you have over someone delivering your or someone else's gold. It's a function of how much leverage you have. You know, so if you turn up, it's that great thing. You turn up with a kilo of gold and put it in a bank, walk around the block and say, I would like my bar of gold, you're probably going to get it. If you turn up with 4 tons of gold, walk around the block and say, I want my 4 tons of gold, you're going to get arrested. And they say they've never seen you before. Whereas if the people with enough political clout, and you might think it would be the Germans, but there's every reason to argue that's the visible side of the system, not the invisible side. So the question is, does your certificate, does your ownership, do you have the leverage to have it physically delivered to you? And I would certainly argue Maduro and the Venezuelans would be a laughable right-hand edge of that. You know, I mean, they're clearly not going to get anything. It's a very difficult subject, and it's all about how much leverage you have on the people who are supposedly storing the physical. It's not something that's easily either conceptualized or explained diagrammatically. I think it fluxes, it changes, and it depends on what tools you're using to deliver the leverage respect to bullion delivery.
So one last thing, and then we'll get to the last subject. That study came, or that we talk about transparency, the LBMA, it wasn't a study. They released their own data back in 2017, showing how many tons they had at the bank, you know, of in the LBMA vaults. It was like 7,500 tons or something, and a vast majority of it was the Bank of England's. And then you had a certain amount, 1,500 tons that were pledged to the ETFs that store their gold there. And there was like 800 tons left over that wasn't, you know, that supposedly had the ability to be, I don't know, lend it out, sold, whatever. I mean, that was a year and a half ago. So again, that begs the question, where are they getting 90 tons a month to ship to Switzerland?
Yeah, I mean, look, so what I'm trying to say is there are two answers. The first is you run with the numbers, so you run with Ronan did an excellent job of putting that apart and explaining how little there is as it floats. Either you run with that as that's the situation, or you say, well, that's very interesting, but I don't buy that.
But I don't buy it.
As being the totality of the story, and I'm certainly of the secondary view. I think that it could even be both stories are true. In other words, that is the actual number. But it's also true that as it gets very close to, as we say in England, squeaky bum time, then pressure can be brought to bear to push someone else's large, dark, physical stash through the system in order to keep it going. I mean, I just don't know. The more years I spend learning, reading, and contemplating this, the dodgier I realize it is, and the more one can't rely on the data. However, the more sure I am that it's all about cash and bonds, and when global capital markets start to panic about the loss of purchasing power of cash and bonds, that will be a massive dynamite underneath the gold price, in inverted commas, which will be the big trigger that we're waiting for. I just think any kind of data on physical is just entirely unreliable.
Yeah. All right, my friend, one last question. As we said, your day job is you're a fund manager, and so you have to manage equities and manage bullion every single day for your clients for a living. This has been, again, a pretty challenging year. We got off to a good first quarter. Everything was looking fine. It has been just brutal, really, ever since April. The shares are, especially the big shares, the big senior producers are all just getting the crap kicked out of them. Everybody on a smaller scale listening to this is probably in the same boat. I mean, we've all got a few shares, we've got bullion and all this kind of stuff, and we're kind of biding our time, trying to manage our way through it the best we can. What, again, you're just kind of doing the same thing on a larger scale. What's the best strategy for, you know, as you navigate along, waiting for this to all happen, you know, with opportunity costs that you've got to pay, obviously, if you just sit still, what strategies do you employ to kind of make the most of it?
Well, look, I mean, it's different, obviously, for a fund manager. I'm selling to institutions. I'm selling a hedge. But what I would say, there are certain things. So I'm very boring and repeat myself on this, but don't just buy a few. I know you just said it. I've got a few. You know, for me, this is just not the right way of doing it. It never has been. The idiosyncratic individual risk profile of a mining stock versus an index or a fund is not in your favor. It just isn't. I'm afraid, you know, I'd love to tell you what it is, but it just isn't. You're going to capture 80%+ of any upside by owning a whole bunch or an index or a fund that you're going to own by owning one. And the one you own is going to be the one that has some unexpected operational problem or whatever other kind of problem that come along, and they come along, and they come along pretty regularly. So for me, the skew is very much in favor of having a larger number of positions rather than a smaller number. So that's my first point. The second, which is good news, is that balance sheets are less stressed now than they were 3 years ago. But 3 years ago, a lot of these companies were in a whole world were really staring down the barrel. They, as a group, have less. So we model it out, and we can estimate pretty well when we're likely to see the share capital raises, problems with the balance sheet in the mid caps and the larger names. The smaller ones are even easier to model out, but we're going to talk about the bigger ones. And it's not as bad as you might think. Now, having said that, we go to $11 silver and 900 gold, then you know, I reserve the right to change my mind. But these prices, it's not quite as desperate as one might think. However, what has happened, of course, is margin compression has gone all the way to effectively zero, which is why they're behaving so badly. But that obviously also is a good news story with potential rise in price. Gold goes up $150, silver goes up $4 or $5. You know, one would say that it's very likely the stocks will run incredibly hard if that happens. So, you know, I think it isn't as bad as it was, because they're being a little bit meaner with their capital, with their shareholder capital. I think that it's still pretty ugly. I mean, the silver stocks in particular, we've had heavy exposure to the larger capital events, has been particularly boosted with the gold silver ratio at 80, whatever it is, 4 or something. But, you know, I think if you have your position sizing right, and this has always been a problem for people in the sector, people like us, is, you know, if you're going to have a very big weighting in your net worth, you have to be able to ride the volatility.
Yeah.
You know, everything you invest in, you need to think about both position sizing and the expected volatility profile of that asset class. Now, if you have that correct, then you shouldn't be worrying about it. You should still be happy with where we are.
Do you find, Ned, actively managing the portfolio still is important? I mean, are you kind of rotating out of maybe seniors more towards juniors, that kind of thing?
No, we don't run it like that. But what we will do is, if we see a production report come through, and fortunately the guy I work with is a trained mine engineer, operated both underground and in open pits. And we can see that there's likely to lead to an earnings miss. We will often sell the stock and buy it back as the market is not sophisticated enough, including sell side, to pick this up. So they'll still be expecting EPS of 5 cents. And, of course, we've realized, for whatever reason, it's only going to be 2 this quarter. We will sell and buy back. We're not rotating the portfolio purely on the basis of scale for any particular reason. We'd rather own quality and meat management a lot and run intensive models and know why we're where we are. But sometimes something comes along that leads us to want to jump out, of course. But no, not that kind of subsector rotation based on short to medium term price moves. That's not something that we do.
Well, all right, my friend. I think this has all been tremendously helpful. And I think anybody listening has benefited from your expertise, as they always do. And I just want to thank you for continuing to fight the fight, man. We've been friends now for, 7 or 8 years? And I think if somebody would have sat us down in, you know, like 2011 and said, hey, by 2018, you guys are going to feel like you've been run over by the same truck and backed up, run over again. But you're still out there selling the message, telling everybody about sound money, and an advocate for all of us. So I just, man, thank you for your time, but thank you for your continued efforts on behalf of all of us. I really appreciate it.
Don't be silly. The same is true of you. And I think maybe we're here for a reason. I don't think any of us that are true sound money advocates are ever going to back down.
Yeah.
We'll always be there on the front foot as long as we're not carried out on a stretcher physically. And look, it's a pleasure. It's the most fun I have doing any kind of callers with you on TFMR. So look, best to everybody, and no doubt I'll be back in due course.
Yes, hopefully we'll talk about some happy stuff and how things are really rolling sometime early in 2019. Until then, man, happy holidays. I hope you're able to enjoy some time with family and friends, and then see if we can hit the ground running when the calendar flips and have a much better year next year than this one.
Thank you. Yeah, fingers crossed.
All right. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I appreciate it. And we'll be back at you with another one of these Thursday conversations next week.